accession number 17572, reel 7.
Paul Millett, reel 4. We were talking about Saudi Arabia and the thing, you know, and about cultural problems.
Yes.
The fact you're jumped straight off the desert. You ultimately knew what sort of how they got accomplished on the tornadoes, what kind of pilots they made. I mean, did they make good pilots? Did they measure up to operational requirements?
Yes, they did. Often to my amazement, because I mentioned the fact that they weren't very keen on training, and they never trained terribly hard, but they would say, the squatting command would say, right, we're going to have an exercise, and they would have an exercise which would be taking the aircraft right to the limits. And we'd say, oh, don't you think you should ease back a bit? No, we're good. And they would do it, and we'd sit in fear and trepidation whilst the exercise went on, and they'd get away with it. It would all work. How, I don't know. I'm sure they had somebody on their side. I watched them one day set up a big Air Force wide exercise, well, not an exercise, demonstration, where Sir George Younger had just become our Minister of Defence, and he came out, and Prince Sultan had invited him for this, to see this Air Force demonstration. They did one practice, which was a complete shambles. They had aircraft arriving from different directions all at the same time, because they didn't get the timing right. Lots of the displays were horrific, and we thought, okay, well, they're sure to have many more practices before but no, they'd done their practice. And so come the day, George Younger went out with Prince Sultan, and it all worked perfectly. Absolutely impossible, but they managed it.
Because, well, I mean, you couldn't call a tornado a forgiving aircraft, could you? I mean, you had to have a high degree of skill to fly it, or...
To operate it, you needed a high degree of skill. To fly it, it was a very simple aeroplane to fly. And we deliberately made it as safe as we possibly could, and I think it was. We found that, interestingly, the less competent crews would often do better than the more competent crews, because particularly the backseat navigators, who, unfortunately, the Saudis tended to look down upon them as being a sort of second-class pilot, and so they put the chaps they didn't want into the back seats. The ones who didn't know what they were doing would just switch it on and let it work, and the system normally worked very well by itself, so they could cope well. The ones who were a little more competent used to try and fiddle it or try and work it, and they would go completely wrong as they didn't know what they were doing. Just goes to show, in many ways, it's a good thing not to try and interfere with the system.
What about ground support? I mean, they learned how to look after them properly and everything.
Yes, they did.
Yeah.
Initially, all the maintenance was done by our own people. We used ex-RAF ground crew, and we took a long time training them. In fact, much too long. As far as the Saudis was concerned, they wanted all their own people to be operating the aircraft fully from very early days, and they got very frustrated at the slowness in their eyes of us converting their ground crew to look after the aircraft. I think there's an element of truth in that. I think we were a bit slow in getting them going because we were trying to be over careful. But it's better to be that way than the other.
And they didn't lose many aircraft in training?
None.
Yeah. Well, therefore that's the proof of it, really.
Yes.
It? Yeah. Mm. Now, they were involved in the Gulf War to a certain extent, weren't they?
Yes, they were.
I don't know how many aircraft they committed, but they tended to take rather a back seat as far as the news coverage was concerned. I mean, did you follow the Gulf War operation?
Yes, I did, but of course not directly, because I moved down to Oman in September 89, just before it all happened. I wasn't prescient. I didn't realise it was Saddam Hussein was going to march into Kuwait, but I kept in fairly close touch with what was happening by telephone, and they were doing pretty well, actually. But I think they deliberately kept a low profile because they didn't really want to be shown as being nasty to an Arab neighbour, even though the Arab neighbour was being nasty to them. It was much better to have the Allied forces there in the forefront.
A clearly identified enemy.
Yes.
And you went to Oman, presumably, in support of the Jaguar sale, did you, to the Omani Air Force?
Not really. The intention when I first went to Oman was that they were going to buy 8 Tornadoes for the Oman Air Force. So I went to help them with getting the Tornado into service. I was quite sure that it was the wrong aircraft for the Oman Air Force, because they couldn't afford to buy many of them. 8 aircraft is not really operationally viable, and you need an awful lot of backup to operate 1 aircraft or 8 aircraft or 80 aircraft, in effect. So it wasn't a cost-effective aircraft for them. It wasn't the aircraft that they really wanted, although they thought they wanted it. And whilst I didn't try and talk them out of the Tornado, I certainly kept talking about them operating the Hawks, which was, I felt, the right aircraft for them. And they did decide that finally the Hawk would be more cost effective, which is absolutely right, and a much better airplane for the Oman Air Force, and that's the aircraft they bought. So,
because the Jaguar was used against the rebels in South Oman, wasn't it? Against the Yemeni or the Aden.
Yes.
Rebel forces way back in Dhofar, wasn't it?
Yes, it was.
And wasn't that, weren't they ostensibly Omani aircraft flown by RAF pilots?
Yes. Not entirely. The Oman Air Force didn't have enough pilots to operate their Jaguars themselves, and so they were using ex-RAF pilots. They actually were, they usually had one seconded pilot from the RAF, but otherwise they had ex-RAF pilots who they took on as Oman Air Force pilots. But of course the Oman Air Force, for a long time, most of the pilots were ex-RAF contract officers.
Mercenaries,
yes.
Yeah.
They did finally Omanize. Yeah. But there's still a number of white faces there.
How long did you spend in Oman?
3 years.
Oh, as long as that?
Lovely country.
Yeah.
Best part of the Middle East, I think.
Yeah. And that was purely in liaising on Jaguar support, was it, once they'd abandoned the idea of Tornadoes?
Yes, and preparing them for the Hawk. Uh-huh. The Hawk didn't actually arrive until I had retired, but we were spending a lot of time getting the contract going.
Where were you actually based? The airport, in that area, or...?
I was based in the headquarters, which is near the Air Force. With a nice house in the capital area, right by the beach.
It's up near the big new university.
Not down that end of town. Did you know Kurram?
I knew it was at Sieve, the main international airport.
Yes, that's right. But my house was was near Muscat, the capital. The office was out near the airport.
And that program was rather like the Saudi tornado program again, was it? Air crew training, ground crew training, and so on that you were.
Yes, yes, that's right. And little things on the which were connected with British Aerospace, like refurbishing their rapiers, which they had it there for defence.
Going back to the Gulf War, I mean, you obviously followed it closely, and particularly the tornado contribution, the rather ill-advised use, as it turned out to be, in airfield denial, because they had quite a lot of casualties in the early stages. Do you have any sort of inside thoughts on that one? I mean, this is obviously what they were trained for and what they were equipped for.
Yes, I haven't talked with the air crew at all, so I've really been a bit divorced, but I certainly watched with great interest what happened, and tried to analyse their losses. They were operating the aircraft in the way it was intended to be operated, at very low level. They didn't actually lose many aircraft to ground fire, whether it's missiles or any other ground fire. They were losing aircraft because they were operating in such an alien way, which was flying in total darkness, with an awful lot of stuff being thrown up at them. So a very tense situation, a war situation, of course. And the aircraft is designed, of course, to be flown hands-off, but they were nearly always losing airplanes when they'd done their attack, and they were manoeuvring at low level over a dark desert and actually flying into the ground, which happened far too often.
Mm. Now, the kind of operation they flew was presumably an anticipated one of what would have happened in Germany.
Yes.
And they would have used the same sort of airfield denial weaponry and so on.
Yep.
So it was possibly a lesson that the air staff learned, but it wouldn't have worked if they tried it. Holes were filled too quickly on airfields and so on.
Well, I'm not sure how effective it actually was. I honestly don't know.
Because were they also? I mean, they're designed for tank busting, I suppose, as well, and so on. Any ground target, the GR-1.
Yes.
Mm. Going back to your lifetime of aviation, I mean, can you put your finger on the nicest aeroplane you flew and the worst aeroplane you flew?
I've been asked certainly the nicest one lots of times, which was my favourite aeroplane. Very difficult to say, because you like so many aeroplanes for different reasons. Like, everybody loves the Tiger Moth. I mean, it's a tremendous fun with the air flying around you and these wires and two wings, and great fun to fly. Spitfire, which everybody wants to fly again, was a really exciting airplane.
Which one did you fly?
I flew the Rolls-Royce 16 with a Griffin engine. And of course, I was used to the Griffin from my Firefly days. It sounded just the same. Yeah. But loved the Spitfire. Yeah, an interesting side comment is that I was also quite certain that if Boscombe Down these days had a Spitfire to evaluate, they would turn it down.
Why?
Because it was very sensitive, and particularly at a slow speed on the approach, very delicate handling it required, which... I like that in an aeroplane, but I don't think it would have got through. They had to do something about that. My all-time favourite has to be Tornado, because it's closest to my heart. It's an aircraft I grew up with from the drawing board to through first flight, a large part of development flying, and right into service. And but one that I thought was a fantastic airplane too. I can't think of one that I didn't enjoy. I mean, lots of airplanes where you think, gosh, that was a bit of a beast, but they all have the fascination and fun. I remember flying a Grumman Avenger one day. They used to have them in the RNVR air squadrons, or one of the RNVR squadrons, and I said, can I fly one? Yeah, sure, there you go. And that was a much bigger aircraft than I'd ever flown at the time. Huge single piston engine. Everything was large, great big cockpit. And you clambered up into this airplane. And when I got into the air, I nearly thought they'd left the control locks in, because the control forces were enormous. Okay, perhaps good in a torpedo bomber, but not one that I thought was the easiest aircraft to fly.
But well, what do you do with yourself now in retirement? Are you still connected with aviation?
No. No, I'm studying geology. That's a little bit different, isn't it? During my time in the Middle East, I used to walk around the desert and looking at rocks and fossils and things and thinking, I really ought to learn more about this. And so on retirement I started doing an Open University course, which I'm continuing, learning more and more about geology and going around the world looking at geology, which is something different, and I enjoy that enormously. I've done a little bit of flying, but not proper aviation, as it were. I did a paragliding course to see what that was like. At the end of that course, I thought, well, that was tremendous fun, but I've got two choices. I either take it up seriously, which means spending an awful lot of time doing it properly, or say, well, I've done that, and so I that's what I felt. I put that on one side and passed on to something else. I've tried hang gliding. I think apart from piloting an air balloon, a hot air balloon, I think I've tried every form of aviation you can think of. And so my feeling about flying is, I wouldn't say you don't miss flying, but I had 10 years in the Middle East when I wasn't flying anyway. But if I went to fly now, what would I fly for? I finished my flying career on the hottest high-performance airplane that we had at the time. Why go back to flying around in a Cessna just for the sake of it? So I haven't taken it up. I did think quite hard at one time about building an aircraft, because I thought that would be fun to build your own airplane and then fly it. But then I think the practicalities of it became more obvious the more I thought about it.
Is Pamela glad you finished flying now, or did she take your flying career with equanimity when you married her? Did she have worrying moments, or...?
I think she must have, but she never actually said so, and she knew how much I enjoyed it. She never suggested that it was something I shouldn't be doing, and she'd never said since I stopped flying, and she's glad I stopped. No, I think she realises that in all of us males there's a touch of the little boy that wants to do these things, and she lets us get on with it.
Just going back to your carrier days, I noticed when I was doing playing the tapes back, I didn't find one moment you were talking about ocean, and the next you were talking about glory, and I didn't pinpoint a crossover point. Presumably, you know, you finished one commission in Ocean, she went home and you joined Laura when she came out, was it?
Yeah, in fact, I was with Glory in the Mediterranean, but the Ocean was getting short of pilots, and they didn't want to bring a pilot out just for the last part of their actual commission in Korea and then go home with them. So they asked if four of us could go out early from Glory. So we flew out to the Far East, courtesy of BOAC, which took a lot longer in those days than it does nowadays, and joined up with Ocean, when we did two patrols with Ocean, and then back to Glory again.
Glory came out to catch up.
Yes, that's right. Mm-hmm.
Yes, that's clear. Fine. Well, I think I've exhausted what few questions I felt were left over from last time.
Right.
I don't know if you think there's anything that needs adding.
Yes, there's one thing I'd like to talk about,
yes.
And this is my flight in Concorde.
Oh, yes.
Which I was very excited and pleased to do. This was during the Concorde development, and when I became chief test pilot up at Wharton of the British Aircraft Corporation military side, Brian Trubshaw was chief test pilot of the civil side, and so I phoned him one day and said, why don't you come up and fly Jaguar one day and then I can come and fly Concorde? And he said, yeah, of course, good idea. So I left in a few days and then said, when can I come and fly Concorde? And we arranged a date for me to go down to Fairford, and I went down, and Trubby was a bit busy that day, so he passed me on to Peter Baker. Peter Baker, in fact, had been my tutor at the Empire Test Pilot School, so I knew him extremely well. He actually introduced me to Pamela whilst I was at Farnborough. that's quite by the way. And I was very happy to fly with Peter. He gave me a short but comprehensive briefing on flying Concorde. Went out of the aircraft. I sat in the left-hand seat, and he talked me through the whole thing, starting up, taxiing, takeoff. We climbed out across the Wash, up the Norwegian coast, until we got up to just north of the Arctic Circle, and then turned west. And the intention was that they were looking for some performance measurements at the usual 60,000 foot altitude, but with higher than normal temperature conditions. And the only place we could forecast, oddly enough, was north of the Arctic Circle for the temperature to be that high. I did all the flying. We turned onto the westerly heading and put it onto autopilot because they wanted very precise flying for the performance measurements. The temperature was not warmer than, well, fractionally warmer. It wasn't warm enough for their performance. So Peter said, okay, well, you can fly it again. So I took it out of autopilot and carried on flying. We went on flying north of Iceland and then turned back down the North Sea, headed back into Fairford. We were intending flying...
Well, the Irish Sea, presumably. Or did you go right round the top of Scotland again?
No, we went... after we'd finished the sort of short of Greenland, we turned back into the North Sea, across the north of Scotland.
Across the north, yeah.
I mean, I increased my Mark II time by... several thousand percent in that one way. But what an aircraft. And I was delighted with it because I'd grown up with Concorde from the point of view of the fact whilst I was at Bedford, a lot of the work we did was headed towards Concorde. We did a lot of simulator flying of Concorde before the thing ever flew. We had the Handypage 115 and the FD2, all aimed at seeing that Concord was going to work, to find how well it actually did work. And I couldn't believe this business of climbing up, going supersonic, continued to accelerate in the climb until you reached the point where you shut the afterburners down, because the intake efficiency is so good that you continue to accelerate and climb without using afterburner. Nothing in my experience touches that, and there isn't an airplane which does it even now. But handling it, I thought, it was a delight. When we came back to Fairford, we had intended to fly several circuits, but the weather had closed in. It wasn't very good, so we did an ILS back into Fairford. And I did, again, hand flew it, not autopilot, but I did put the auto throttle in, so I didn't have to worry about the speed that was being controlled by the auto throttle. I just drove it on the stick. And we finally got below cloud, and I could see a murky runway in front of me, so I came off the instruments and went on to eyeballing it. And a very laconic voice from Peter next to me said, getting a little low on the glide path. And so I went back onto ILS, and sure enough, I was well below the glide path. But this was because the eye position is so high relative to the aircraft that you don't realise the bit you're landing on is a long way behind and below you. I got it back on the glide path, and then I did slightly worry about being so far away from the runway on landing, like standing on top of a tall tower. But I didn't find that was difficult, because the technique is, as you get close to the ground, the engineer is calling out the height on the radio altimeter, and probably his voice is slightly going up in pitch as you get close to the ground, and automatically you ease back on the stick as this happens. And I found, to my a very agreeable surprise, I did a gentle touchdown, which was a real greaser. And we didn't, because the weather was so bad, we didn't throw a lot of circuit, we just did that single approach and landing. But the only thing I found as a steely-eyed test pilot that I didn't like about Concorde was taxiing it, and this was an early one, remember, is that tremendously long nose earlier was much too soft. And so as you were going around, and Fairford's not the smoothest of airfields, as you were taxi around, the aircraft was bouncing up and down, and the nose was going way up and down. And apart from almost feeling sick with it, I reckon the passengers were not going to enjoy sitting in an airliner which was doing that. So they did stiffen up that earlier, certainly. But otherwise, what a wonderful airplane.
Did you mention you'd flown the F-15?
Yes.
What are your memories of that?
I managed to get a flight at Bitburg with the United States Air Force. And that's probably the highest performance airplane by a long way that I've ever flown. And that, compared with aircraft like the F-104, is a wonderful handling machine, and at slow speed you can do anything with it as well. It probably has got a few vices, but in one flight you didn't find don't find any vices. I thought it was a real pilot's aeroplane.
Did you check out its rate of climb?
Briefly, I didn't do a complete climb up to a supersonic climb to altitude, because there's so many things you want to do in any one flight. They only had one flight in it. It was, I suppose, aimed at looking at the weapon system, but which I didn't really get an awful lot of out of, because I had an hour in the simulator flying a totally different weapon system than anything I've learned before. And you really need a lot more time than that to take in a complex weapon system. But I was looking more at the handling.
Because when you've flown so many different types, how long does it take you to get used to a new machine? I mean, presumably you've got handling notes to go through, or you've got a personal briefing. Do you get the feel of a new aircraft pretty quickly?
Oh, yes.
I mean, you're given the parameters like rotating speed and unstick speed and climb out and approach and everything else before you actually get in, I suppose.
Yes, of course.
Yeah.
But you do get the feel of it very quickly. And the thing which... all right, perhaps not the same with Tornado, which I really got to know very well, but most new aircraft, you go along and you have a briefing, which is quite comprehensive, but by the time you get around to flying the aircraft, you remember the salient points, which you have to remember, but the systems, which can be quite complex, you don't remember. But once you've flown it, you go back and then read up the systems. They make a lot more sense in that context.